that education is both rigorous and rigid, these answers come to exert a deep hold on the scientific mind. That they can do so does much to account both for the peculiar efficiency of the normal research activity and for the direction in which it proceeds at any given time. When examining normal science in sections 3, 4, and 5, we shall want finally to describe that research as a strenuous and devoted attempt to force nature into the conceptual boxes supplied by professional education. Simultaneously, we shall wonder whether research could proceed without such boxes, whatever the element of arbitrariness in their historic origins, and occasionally in their subsequent development. Yet that element of arbitrariness is present, and it too has an important effect on scientific development, one which will be examined in detail in sections 6, 7, and 8. Normal science, the activity in which most scientists inevitably spend almost all their time, is predicated on the assumption that the scientific community knows what the world is like. Much of the success of the enterprise derives from the community's willingness to defend that assumption, if necessary at considerable cost. Normal science, for example, often suppresses fundamental novelties because they are necessarily subversive of its basic commitments. Nevertheless, so long as those commitments retain an element of the arbitrary, the very nature of normal research ensures that novelty shall not be suppressed for very long. Sometimes a normal problem, one that ought to be solvable by known rules and procedures, resists the reiterated onslaught of the ablest members of the group within whose competence it falls. On other occasions, a piece of equipment, designed and constructed for the purpose of normal research, fails to perform in the anticipated manner, revealing an anomaly that cannot, despite repeated effort, be aligned with professional expectation. In these and other ways besides, normal science repeatedly goes astray. And when it does, when, that is, the profession can no longer evade anomalies that subvert the existing tradition of scientific practice, then begin the extraordinary investigations that lead the profession at last to a new set of commitments, a new basis for the practice of science. The extraordinary episodes in which that shift of professional commitments occurs are the ones known in this essay as scientific revolutions. They are the tradition-shattering complements to the tradition-bound activity of normal science. The most obvious examples of scientific revolutions are those famous episodes in scientific development that have often been labeled revolutions before. Therefore, in sections 9 and 10, where the nature of scientific revolutions is first directly scrutinized, we shall deal repeatedly with the major turning points in scientific development associated with the names of Copernicus, Newton, Lavoisier, and Einstein. More clearly than most other episodes in the history of at least the physical sciences, these display what all scientific revolutions are about. Each of them necessitated the community's rejection of one time-honored scientific theory in favor of another incompatible with it. Each produced a consequent shift in the problems available for scientific scrutiny, and in the standards by which the profession determined what should count as an admissible problem or as a legitimate problem solution. And each transformed the scientific imagination in ways that we shall ultimately need to describe as a transformation of the world within which scientific work was done. Such changes, together with the controversies that almost always accompany them, are the defining characteristics of scientific revolutions. These characteristics emerge with particular clarity from a study of, say, the Newtonian or the chemical revolution. It is, however, a fundamental thesis of this essay that they can also be retrieved from the study of many other episodes that were not so obviously revolutionary. For the far smaller professional group affected by them, Maxwell's equations were as revolutionary as Einstein's, and they were resisted accordingly. The invention of other new theories regularly and appropriately evokes the same response from some of the specialists on whose area of special competence they impinge. For these men, the new theory implies a change in the rules governing the prior practice of normal science. Inevitably, therefore, it reflects upon much scientific work they have already successfully completed. That is why a new theory, however special its range of application, is seldom or never just an increment to what is already known. Its assimilation requires the reconstruction of prior theory and the reevaluation of prior fact, an intrinsically revolutionary process that is seldom completed by a single man and never overnight. No wonder historians have had difficulty in dating precisely this extended process that their vocabulary impels them to view as an isolated event. Nor are new inventions of theory the only scientific events that have revolutionary impact upon the specialists in whose domain they occur. The commitments that govern normal science specify not only what sorts of entities the universe does contain, but also, by implication, those that it does not. It follows, though the point will require extended discussion, that a discovery like that of oxygen, or X-rays, does not simply add one more item to the population of the scientist's world. Ultimately, it has that effect, but not until the professional community has reevaluated traditional experimental procedures, altered its conception of entities with which it has long been familiar, and, in the process, shifted the network of theory through which it deals with the world. Scientific fact and theory are not categorically separable, except perhaps within a single tradition of normal scientific practice. That is why the unexpected discovery is not simply factual in its import, and why the scientist's world is qualitatively transformed, as well as quantitatively enriched, by fundamental novelties of either fact or theory. This extended conception of the nature of scientific revolutions is the one delineated in the pages that follow. Admittedly, the extension strains customary usage. Nevertheless, I shall continue to speak even of discoveries as revolutionary, because it is just the possibility of relating their structure to that of, say, the Copernican Revolution that makes the extended conception seem to me so important. The preceding discussion indicates how the complementary notions of normal science and of scientific revolutions will be developed in the 9 sections immediately to follow. The rest of the essay attempts to dispose of 3 remaining central questions. Section 11, by discussing the textbook tradition, considers why scientific revolutions have previously been so difficult to see. Section 12 describes the revolutionary competition between the proponents of the old normal scientific tradition and the adherents of the new one. It thus considers the process that should somehow, in a theory of scientific inquiry, replace the confirmation or falsification procedures made familiar by our usual image of science. Competition between segments of the scientific community is the only historical process that ever actually results in the rejection of one previously accepted theory or in the adoption of another. Finally, Section 13 will ask how development through revolutions can be compatible with the apparently unique character of scientific progress. For that question, however, this essay will provide no more than the main outlines of an answer, one which depends upon characteristics of the scientific community that require much additional exploration and study. Undoubtedly, some listeners will already have wondered whether historical study can possibly affect the sort of conceptual transformation aimed at here. An entire arsenal of dichotomies is available to suggest that it cannot properly do so. History, we too often say, is a purely descriptive discipline. The theses suggested above are, however, often interpretive and sometimes normative. Again, many of my generalizations are about the sociology or social psychology of scientists. Yet at least a few of my conclusions belong traditionally to logic or epistemology. In the preceding paragraph, I may even seem to have violated the very influential contemporary distinction between the context of discovery and the context of justification. Can anything more than profound confusion be indicated by this admixture of diverse fields and concerns? Having been weaned intellectually on these distinctions, and others like them, I could scarcely be more aware of their import and force. For many years I took them to be about the nature of knowledge, and I still suppose that, appropriately recast, they have something important to tell us. Yet my attempts to apply them, even grosso modo, to the actual situations in which knowledge is gained, accepted, and assimilated, have made them seem extraordinarily problematic. Rather than being elementary logical or methodological distinctions, which would thus be prior to the analysis of scientific knowledge, they now seem integral parts of a traditional set of substantive answers to the very questions upon which they have been deployed. That circularity does not at all invalidate them, but it does make them parts of a theory, and by doing so, subjects them to the same scrutiny regularly applied to theories in other fields. If they are to have more than pure abstraction as their content, then that content must be discovered by observing them in application to the data they are meant to elucidate. How could history of science fail to be a source of phenomena to which theories about knowledge may legitimately be asked to apply? Chapter 2. The Route to Normal Science. In this essay, normal science means research firmly based upon one or more past scientific achievements. Achievements that some particular scientific community acknowledges, for a time, as supplying the foundation for its further practice. Today, such achievements are recounted, though seldom in their original form, by science textbooks, elementary and advanced. These textbooks expound the body of accepted theory, illustrate many or all of its successful applications, and compare these applications with exemplary observations and experiments. Before such books became popular early in the 19th century, and until even more recently in the newly matured sciences, many of the famous classics of science fulfilled a similar function. Aristotle's Physica, Ptolemy's Almagest, Newton's Principia and Optics, Franklin's Electricity, Lavoisier's Chemistry, and Lyell's Geology. These and many other works served for a time, implicitly, to define the legitimate problems and methods of a research field for succeeding generations of practitioners. They were able to do so because they shared two essential characteristics. Their achievement was sufficiently unprecedented to attract an enduring group of adherents away from competing modes of scientific activity. Simultaneously, it was sufficiently open-ended to leave all sorts of problems for the redefined group of practitioners to resolve. Achievements that share these two characteristics I shall henceforth refer to as paradigms, a term that relates closely to normal science. By choosing it, I mean to suggest that some accepted examples of actual scientific practice, examples which include law, theory, application, and instrumentation together, provide models from which spring particular coherent traditions of scientific research. These are the traditions which the historian describes under such rubrics as Ptolemaic astronomy, or Copernican, Aristotelian dynamics, or Newtonian, corpuscular optics, or wave optics, and so on. The study of paradigms including many that are far more specialized than those named illustratively above, is what mainly prepares the student for membership in the particular scientific community with which he will later practice. Because he there joins men who learned the bases of their field from the same concrete models, his subsequent practice will seldom evoke overt disagreement over fundamentals. Men whose research is based on shared paradigms are committed to the same rules and standards for scientific practice. That commitment, and the apparent consensus it produces, are prerequisites for normal science, i.e., for the genesis and continuation of a particular research tradition. Because in this essay, the concept of a paradigm will often substitute for a variety of familiar notions, more will need to be said about the reasons for its introduction. Why is the concrete scientific achievement, as a locus of professional commitment, prior to the various concepts, laws, theories, and points of view that may be abstracted from it? In what sense is the shared paradigm a fundamental unit for the student of scientific development, a unit that cannot be fully reduced to logically atomic components, which might function in its stead? When we encounter them in Section 5, answers to these questions and to others like them will prove basic to an understanding both of normal science and of the associated concept of paradigms. That more abstract discussion will depend, however, upon a previous exposure to examples of normal science or of paradigms in operation. In particular, both these related concepts will be clarified by noting that there can be a sort of scientific research without paradigms, or at least without any so unequivocal and so binding as the ones named above. Acquisition of a paradigm, and of the more esoteric type of research it permits, is a sign of maturity in the development of any given scientific field. If the historian traces the scientific knowledge of any selected group of related phenomena backward in time, he is likely to encounter some minor variant of a pattern here illustrated from the history of physical optics. Today's physics textbooks tell the student that light is photons, i.e., quantum mechanical entities that exhibit some characteristics of waves and some of particles. Research proceeds accordingly, or rather according to the more elaborate and mathematical characterization from which this usual verbalization is derived. That characterization of light is, however, scarcely half a century old. Before it was developed by Planck, Einstein, and others early in this century, physics texts taught that light was transverse wave motion, a conception rooted in a paradigm that derived, ultimately, from the optical writings of Young and Fresnel in the early 19th century. Nor was the wave theory the first to be embraced by almost all practitioners of optical science. During the 18th century, the paradigm for this field was provided by Newton's optics, which taught that light was material corpuscles. At that time, physicists sought evidence, as the early wave theorists had not, of the pressure exerted by light particles impinging on solid bodies. These transformations of the paradigms of physical optics are scientific revolutions, and the successive transition from one paradigm to another via revolution is the usual developmental pattern of mature science. It is not, however, the pattern characteristic of the period before Newton's work, and that is the contrast that concerns us here. No period between remote antiquity and the end of the 17th century exhibited a single, generally accepted view about the nature of light. Instead, there were a number of competing schools and subschools, most of them espousing one variant or another of Epicurean, Aristotelian, or Platonic theory. One group took light to be particles emanating from material bodies. For another, it was a modification of the medium that intervened between the body and the eye. Still another explained light in terms of an interaction of the medium with an emanation from the eye. And there were other combinations and modifications besides. Each of the corresponding schools derived strength from its relation to some particular metaphysic. And each emphasized, as paradigmatic observations, the particular cluster of optical phenomena that its own theory could do most to explain. Other observations were dealt with by ad hoc elaborations, or they remained as outstanding problems for further research. At various times, all these schools made significant contributions to the body of concepts, phenomena, and techniques from which Newton drew the first, nearly uniformly accepted paradigm for physical optics. Any definition of the scientist that excludes at least the more creative members of these various schools will exclude their modern successors as well. Those men were scientists. Yet anyone examining a survey of physical optics before Newton may well conclude that, though the field's practitioners were scientists, the net result of their activity was something less than science. Being able to take no common body of belief for granted, each writer on physical optics felt forced to build his field anew from its foundations. In doing so, his choice of supporting observation and experiment was relatively free, for there was no standard set of methods or of phenomena that every optical writer felt forced to employ and explain. Under these circumstances, the dialogue of the resulting books was often directed as much to the members of other schools as it was to nature. That pattern is not unfamiliar in a number of creative fields today, nor is it incompatible with significant discovery and invention. It is not, however, the pattern of development that physical optics acquired after Newton, and that other natural sciences make familiar today. The history of electrical research in the first half of the 18th century provides a more concrete and better known example of the way a science develops before it acquires its first universally received paradigm. During that period, there were almost as many views about the nature of electricity as there were important electrical experimenters, men like Hawkesby, Gray, de Saguelay, Dufay, Nollet, Watson, Franklin, and others. All their numerous concepts of electricity had something in common. They were partially derived from one or another version of the mechanico-corpuscular philosophy that guided all scientific research of the day. In addition, all were components of real scientific theories, of theories that had been drawn in part from experiment and observation, and that partially determined the choice and interpretation of additional problems undertaken in research. Yet though all the experiments were electrical, and though most of the experimenters read each other's works, their theories had no more than a family resemblance. One early group of theories, following 17th century practice, regarded attraction and frictional generation as the fundamental electrical phenomena. This group tended to treat repulsion as a secondary effect, due to some sort of mechanical rebounding, and also to postpone for as long as possible both discussion and systematic research on Gray's newly discovered effect, electrical conduction. Other electricians, the term is their own, took attraction and repulsion to be equally elementary manifestations of electricity, and modified their theories and research accordingly. Actually, this group is remarkably small. Even Franklin's theory never quite accounted for the mutual repulsion of two negatively charged bodies. But they had as much difficulty as the first group in accounting simultaneously for any but the simplest conduction effects. Those effects, however, provided the starting point for still a third group, one which tended to speak of electricity as a fluid that could run through conductors, rather than as an effluvium that emanated from non-conductors. This group, in its turn, had difficulty reconciling its theory with a number of attractive and repulsive effects. Only through the work of Franklin and his immediate successors did a theory arise that could account, with something like equal facility, for very nearly all these effects, and that therefore could, and did, provide a subsequent generation of electricians with a common paradigm for its research. Excluding those fields like mathematics and astronomy, in which the first firm paradigms date from prehistory, and also those like biochemistry, that arose by division and recombination of specialties already matured, the situations outlined above are historically typical. Though it involves my continuing to employ the unfortunate simplification that tags an extended historical episode with a single and somewhat arbitrarily chosen name, e.g. Newton or Franklin, I suggest that similar fundamental disagreements characterized, for example, the study of motion before Aristotle, and of statics before Archimedes, the study of heat before Black, of chemistry before Boyle and Boerhaave, and of historical geology before Hutton. In parts of biology, the study of heredity, for example, the first universally received paradigms are still more recent. And it remains an open question what parts of social science have yet acquired such paradigms at all. History suggests that the road to a firm research consensus is extraordinarily arduous. History also suggests, however, some reasons for the difficulties encountered on that road. In the absence of a paradigm, or some candidate for paradigm, all of the facts that could possibly pertain to the development of a given science are likely to seem equally relevant. As a result, early fact gathering is a far more nearly random activity than the one that subsequent scientific development makes familiar. Furthermore, in the absence of a reason for seeking some particular form of more recondite information, early fact gathering is usually restricted to the wealth of data that lie ready to hand. The resulting pool of facts contains those accessible to casual observation and experiment, together with some of the more esoteric data retrievable from established crafts like medicine, calendar making, and metallurgy. Because the crafts are one readily accessible source of facts that could not have been casually discovered, technology has often played a vital role in the emergence of new sciences. But though this sort of fact collecting has been essential to the origin of many significant sciences, anyone who examines, for example, Pliny's encyclopedic writings or the Baconian natural histories of the 17th century will discover that it produces a morass. One somehow hesitates to call the literature that results scientific. The Baconian histories of heat, color, wind, mining, and so on are filled with information, some of it recondite. But they juxtapose facts that will later prove revealing, e.g. heating by mixture, with others, e.g. the warmth of dung heaps, that will for some time remain too complex to be integrated with theory at all. In addition, since any description must be partial, the typical natural history often omits, from its immensely circumstantial accounts, just those details that later scientists will find sources of important illumination. Almost none of the early histories of electricity, for example, mention that chaff, attracted to a rubbed glass rod, bounces off again. That effect seemed mechanical, not electrical. Moreover, since the casual fact-gatherer seldom possesses the time or the tools to be critical, the natural histories often juxtapose descriptions like the above with others, say, heating by antiperistasis or by cooling, that we are now quite unable to confirm. Only very occasionally, as in the cases of ancient statics, dynamics, and geometrical optics,